BP settles with victims of the 2010 Gulf oil spill.
Perhaps the letters BP should now stand for billions paid.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon. This is the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, March 5th.
Coming up, we'll hear about the economies of two big states that'll play a big role in tomorrow's Super Tuesday voting.
A world leader goes on trial for his role in the economic collapse of 2008.
And sometimes cleaning your room can really pay off.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
The big oil company BP has settled with thousands of Gulf Coast residents and businesses for their economic losses and medical claims from its massive 2010 oil spill to the tune of $7.8 billion. That's a pretty big number. But today, investors ran towards BP because of that news. Still, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, a bigger bill may still be to come for BP from the U.S. government's investigation of the disaster.
Oil industry analysts are saying BP got off pretty easy in this first round in court. Earlier estimates on the cost of BP settling private claims were as high as $14 billion. Next up, U.S. government charges of violations of the Clean Water Act. Fines and penalties here could go as high as $40 billion, though a settlement instead of a court trial would likely save a bundle for BP and its partners in the Deepwater Horizon rig. And does all this financial risk deter more deepwater drilling? Not likely, says Manachir Takin at the Center for Global Energy Studies in London.
The world does need oil, and the operations will continue.
Starting with lots of promising places offshore in the Gulf of Mexico.
We have had many billion barrel fields discovered, or the total reserves are tens of billions of barrels. That potential extends further south towards Mexico. We have offshore Brazil deep water. We have offshore West Africa.
All in depths unheard of for drilling a decade ago, as much as 18,000 feet below the surface of the sea. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Voters in 10 states will have their say tomorrow in the Republican presidential race, among them Ohio, Tennessee, and Georgia. Marketplace's David Gura has been talking to voters in Georgia, which is, of course, the home state of Newt Gingrich, for our election coverage of the real economy, what matters most to voters this election year. David Gura joins us now from Atlanta. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, David, you've been reporting from there, speaking with the people in Georgia. Is the economy a bigger factor there than it has been in some of the other primary states so far?
Well, I think that here in Georgia, we're seeing a lot of the big economic issues playing out that are playing out in states across the country. Maybe a few of them are in finer focus. Georgia is a state that's experienced a lot of growth over the last few decades. It's been very active trying to get companies to move to Georgia. I've been driving around Atlanta, and you see these giant warehouses. Some big companies are based here, or they've got big facilities here. Keeping those businesses in Atlanta, in Georgia, and attracting more businesses like those, that's pretty important to voters here. Now, there are a couple of other big economic issues here. Number one is housing. We were in North Georgia yesterday, in neighborhoods that sort of sprouted up before the housing bubble burst. And there were foreclosure signs and for sale signs on every street we drove down. I'd say the second issue is unemployment, Jeremy. It's still hovering just below 10% here.
So housing and unemployment are big issues. Is that what voters have on their minds as they head to the polls tomorrow?
You know, I was talking about those for sale signs a second ago. You don't have to go too far away from downtown Atlanta before you see campaign signs. I've spotted Gingrich signs, Santorum signs. I was talking to Sue Ellen Daniels in Forsyth County, and she said that with all these candidates, there's a fundamental disconnect when it comes to the economy.
You can take a tour and you can drive down their street. You can shake their hands. Those 2 or 3 minutes aren't going to make any difference. You're really not walking in their shoes. You're not living in their neighborhood. You're not watching them struggle day to day.
And she told me that when she's just trying to get by, Jeremy, it's really hard for her to focus on politics. She says it can be pretty destructive.
Marketplace's David Gura in Atlanta, where Kai Rizdahl will be there with David. They'll be broadcasting a Marketplace later today. Thanks, David.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, another one of the biggest contests to watch tomorrow will be Ohio. So let's continue our coverage of the real economy now with this report from Elizabeth Wynn Johnson.
This week, Ohio is to Mitt Romney, as New York is to Frank Sinatra.
If I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere.
University of Maryland economist Peter Morisi ticks off the factors that make Ohio stand out as a predictive microcosm.
It has a finance sector as big as manufacturing. It has a lot of high tech and green energy. So it looks a lot like the future.
Ohio's 7.9% unemployment is slightly better than the national average. Its evangelical Christian voters may not be inclined to stray from a social values agenda, so Romney has no choice but to rely on his economic message to convince voters he's better.
If you're happy with your Chevy, why switch to a Ford? The answer is Ford has to be qualitatively better. It has to be different. And the real question is, does Mr. Romney really offer that?
There will be a lot of eyes watching to see how Super Tuesday answers. In Washington, I'm Elizabeth Wynn Johnson for Marketplace.
We are less than 6 weeks away from tax day, and the IRS is going to have to do more with less this year when it comes to processing all those returns. That's thanks to recent budget cuts. But President Obama has proposed giving the IRS an 8% budget boost in the hopes of bringing in more revenue to the government. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
IRS budget cuts over the past 2 years are just part of the across-the-board belt tightening designed to rein in the federal deficit.
Cutting the IRS will increase the deficit. That's a fact.
Colleen Kelly is the president of the National Treasury Employees Union, representing IRS workers. With fewer auditors chasing down tax scofflaws, Kelly says revenue will decline. By one government estimate, every extra dollar invested in the IRS returns nearly $4.50 to the Treasury. The IRS's taxpayer advocate, Nina Olson, in her annual report this year, said the service has become underfunded and overworked.
The IRS's workload has increased a lot over the last few years. That's a combination of Congress passing an average of one tax law change a day. In addition, some of these new programs are disbursement programs, like the first-time homebuyer credit, which are very challenging to the IRS to administer.
The result is worse service. Olson says 3 out of 10 taxpayers who phone in for help never get through. That hurts voluntary compliance, also cutting into the government's take. But hiring more IRS workers comes at a price, says Eugene Sterley. He wrote a book about the IRS budget 20 years ago. Today he keeps tabs on tax policy at the Urban Institute.
When you put more people into IRS, you do increase the revenues of government because they're going to be able to audit and track down more people. But you actually don't increase national income. In fact, you could argue you decrease it a little because more people policing what's going on in society doesn't really add to the output of society.
A better way to raise money, he says, would be to simplify tax laws. That could boost savings at the IRS, which would need fewer agents to enforce less complicated rules. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. You know, Bob, here in the U.S., if I told you we were going to grow at a rate of 7.5% in the economy this year,
woohoo!
That would be pretty good. But in China today, that news is seen as a disappointment. The government there, led by Premier Wen Jiabao, said that the growth there is only going to be 7.5% this year. Only 7.5%, measly. It is the first time since 2005 that the growth goal has fallen below 8%, a number that is considered critical for keeping the Chinese population happy. The BBC's John Sudworth joins us from Shanghai with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us why this 7.5% is so significant compared to what we've seen recently, which is 8% or above.
Well, it's always been said that China needs growth at a level somewhere around 8% or above simply to keep up. That's been the sort of accepted picture up until now. So to drop below that 8% figure is seen as significant. But there's a reason that it's being done. And that's simply because a lot of people say that the model for China is starting to run out of steam. That 8%, 9% year on year is starting itself to be a problem. So this is all about economic rebalancing. And Premier Wen, in his speech today, said that the focus for this year will be on moving away from export-led growth and trying to get Chinese consumers to take up the slack.
John, does that mean that the government there is less concerned about unrest among its citizens?
Well, if anything, it's an admission that they are concerned about it. What they're saying is that those levels of growth have been achieved by focusing on exports, by focusing on big infrastructure spending. But that kind of development is leaving people behind. It comes at a cost, and that cost is inequality and social unrest. We've seen the village protests. We've seen rising ethnic tension, all of those problems that people are aware China's facing today.
The BBC's John Sudworth in Shanghai. Thanks, John.
It's a pleasure.
And for more on this, let's bring in Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. She's with us from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why was this target lowered and why does it matter?
Look, China's going through a political transition right now to new leaders, and they're trying to keep people happy. And in particular, inflation has been a big problem in China. Food inflation has hurt Chinese consumers. And they want, by targeting lower growth, they hope to keep that inflation in check and keep people happy during this transition period.
And one of the things that the Chinese government wants to do is to reduce China's reliance on exports. What does that mean for us over here?
Well, that's actually good news for the U.S. One of the things that has weighed on U.S. growth is that we've been importing more stuff from China and exporting less. And this has really eroded our manufacturing base over the last three decades. We all want to turn that around. So the stronger China is, the more we can export to them instead of the other way around. And that will help our manufacturing sector regain footing.
And just to be clear, Julia, 7.5% growth in China is actually low, even though here it would be quite high.
Exactly. Wouldn't we love to see 7.5% growth? But for them, it is down from more like 9 to 10.
All relative. Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. Thanks as always.
It's a pleasure.
Now to Iceland, which you may remember suffered a total financial collapse back in 2008. And today, the country's former prime minister goes on trial for his role in it. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Geir Horta stands accused of criminal negligence. It's alleged that his government bungled by allowing the Icelandic banks to grow too big. When they collapsed in 2008, Iceland's economy was plunged into deep recession. When he appeared in court this morning, Geir Horta denounced his trial as politically motivated. Torstein Paulsen, himself a former prime minister, agrees.
I think most people regard it as a political charge against the former prime minister.
If found guilty, Horta could get up to 2 years in jail. Legal experts say he'll likely beat the charges, but the trial will explore an interesting question. Who was most to blame for the financial crisis? The banks that inflated the credit bubble, or the politicians and officials who stood by watching the bubble grow? In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, for more, we're joined from Reykjavik by Icelandic TV journalist Egil Helgason. Thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be with you.
What exactly is the former prime minister accused of?
Well, he's basically accused of negligence, that the banking system and the financial system outgrew the economy of the island by, 10 times, and then it collapsed, and that he could have done things to prevent this. And there's also a question of some savings account that Icelandic banks had in the UK and Holland, which have been very problematic for our recovery and for our economy, that he could have averted that disaster. So it's basically a question of negligence.
And I would imagine those other countries have brought to bear a lot of political pressure.
Well, not on this trial. This trial is a very internal matter. It stems from an investigative report written by a committee for the parliament. So this is a unique event, and he has been testifying, the former prime minister, this morning.
It's unusual there. It's unusual everywhere. He seems to be one of the only political figures in the world actually being charged with a crime for the financial crisis. Can you really blame Iceland's financial predicament on one man?
That is the problem. This is becoming a matter of political division. So one has to say that this is a bit of a failure. When this was voted for in the parliament, it was very narrow. And he was, so this trial is going on. And it's not really enjoying the total support of the population and not the total support of the parliament. So it has become very politicized.
Egil Helgason, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
A new study by Expedia.com and Harris Interactive has looked at how Americans view travel in light of the current economic situation, and it appears that people are interested in driving across the country. 25% of men and 33% of women want to drive across the country at least once in their lifetime, and that is the focus of today's Midday Extra. And we've got Jamie Jensen, who is the author of Road Trip USA, on the line with us from Berkeley, California. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Jamie, tell us about this. Is this an increase in the number of people who are interested in driving across the country?
Well, I don't know if it's an increase, but it's certainly been a constant. I mean, it's one of these bucket list things to do is to, you know, drive across America. You look at New York, you look at L.A., and you want to see what's in between. So, but I'm glad to hear people still want to get out there and do it because it's great fun.
Well, been there, done that. Is there a reason that so many Americans want to travel across the country?
Well, I think there's a lot. I mean, one thing, other sorts of travel, if you've been on an airplane any time recently, there's a lot of hassle involved, whereas a road trip
yeah.
is fun. You know, you're in control. You can go where you want, when you want, and nobody's kind of making you wait in line so much. And especially when you get away from the big cities, which is where road tripping really comes into its own. I think hitting the highway is like one of these classic American experiences.
Jamie, I must say, from personal experience, the last couple of years, I've tried to take my vacations domestically because it's so expensive right now to fly overseas. And is that happening more? More people traveling within the U.S. right now because of all that?
For sure. I mean, there's lots and lots of reasons. And lots of people from elsewhere in the world want to come to America because although our gas prices are high, they're still what half it costs in Germany and England and Italy and any place like that. So we've actually got it not so bad.
Yeah, I was going to ask. At least I took my cross-country trip a long time ago when gas was a lot cheaper. Huh. So isn't that discouraging people?
I think it maybe makes them think twice about driving 200 miles to check out a burger joint somewhere, which is what I did, you know, in my early days of road tripping. It makes you maybe stay a little bit closer to home, you know, but it's still a pretty good value for money to get out there, and you can have lots of little adventures along the way. You don't necessarily need to drive 1,000 miles. I mean, this whole staycation, exploring your own backyard, there's lots of smaller road tripping adventures that people are having that really make sense financially and, you know, for the fun.
Jamie, how many times have you driven across the country?
I've done, you know, dozens of cross-country, and I do lots of loop trips, too. Like, I'll fly into St. Louis and get a car and cruise around the Midwest, and then you don't kind of feel drawn to have to do 1,000 miles to get to the coast for sunrise, which is one of the downsides of a cross-country trip. I think you just want to get to the other end.
What's the best route, north, south, or middle?
They're all good. I mean, the great fun is just being out there and realizing, you know, the time is your own to do what you want. The road trip, you're making your own fun, and you find little things along the way, which is what I always find. You know, I've done this for 30 years now, been traveling around the country, and there's always something I'd never heard about before, but I really kind of fall in love with. And that's the great fun of a road trip, is having those experiences that are surprise and adventurous.
What would you say is the most popular? Is it I-80, or is it the old ancient Route 66, or what?
Oh, yeah, not I-80, not I-95. It is these, you know, the blue highways that William Lee Heat Moon made famous, you know, a generation ago almost. But getting off on these two lanes and cruising down, going through the small towns of middle America, you know, finding a great road along the coast somewhere that isn't a freeway. There's lots of these blue roads that are, you know, 2, 3, 4 lanes that not everyone's going 75 miles an hour. And you can just drive and experience the landscape and find a little piece of pie and a cup of coffee at a roadside diner. And that's really what I think the road trip experience is so attractive to people.
Bob, which one did you do?
I did both, Route 66 and I-80.
Which did you like better?
Route 66.
Which ends right here in L.A., right?
Get your kicks, right?
Well, Jamie Jensen, author of Road Trip USA, thanks so much for talking with us.
Hey, thank you.
Well, you probably didn't see this when you were crossing Route 66, Bob, but you know those little square barcodes, the QR codes?
Oh, the QR codes,
that companies, you know, they want you to scan with your smartphone and learn more about products.
That's a pain.
It is a pain, and I don't really understand the value of it yet. And apparently, we're not alone in that view. At least I'm not alone in that view. The people at Mashable.com, the tech-savvy people over there, have put together a list of some of the most ridiculous QR code uses. One is a small plane with a banner ad trailing behind it, which has no words on it, just a QR code. I don't know if you're sitting at the beach and you're supposed to hold your smartphone up and zoom way in to get that. Another is a cereal box with a code that you're supposed to scan every hour for a different video.
Okay.
Because, you know, most people take 8-hour cereal breaks in the day. Or my favorite, a gravestone in Europe with the name of the deceased and a QR code in case you want to learn more about her.
Oh, no.
Remember when you used to pay the paperboy? Well, today the Los Angeles Times is joining a growing trend to make you pay for online access, following in the footsteps of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. It'll start charging for certain content it is placing behind what's known as a paywall. But can it really deliver the dollars the financially strapped LA Times needs? Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
The New York Times is the online model others want to imitate. It's locked some online content behind a paywall and still attracted almost 400,000 paid subscribers. Sarah Barry James is with SNL Kagan, a research firm focusing on media. She says the New York Times paywall won't be its salvation.
It's by no means a silver bullet for the company. The revenues that they are earning from their digital paywall are not making up for the print revenues that they are losing.
Nonetheless, even smaller papers are doing it. The publisher Gannett recently said it would introduce paywalls at 82 of its regional papers. Ken Doctor is a media analyst for Outsell. He says regional papers haven't seen inspiring results from paywalls.
They're not seeing a lot of new signups in terms of new customers.
Online readers of the LA Times won't be locked out completely. Each month, readers can access 15 articles on the website for free. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Jeremy, any guess who's responsible for the St. Louis Blues?
The Blues Brothers?
No. You know, you might say W.C. Handy. He composed the song. Or you might say who's in charge of the hockey team by that name.
Yeah.
But no, we're talking about the men and women in blue at the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department.
Uh-huh.
The city is trying to go back in history and reclaim control of its namesake law enforcement agency because it's actually, I didn't know this, run by the state.
Huh.
And supporters claim that's taxation without representation. First, though, voters have to approve a ballot initiative. Here's St. Louis Public Radio's Julie Bierock.
This fight goes all the way back to the Civil War. In 1861, Missouri's governor sympathized with the Confederacy, so he took over control of the St. Louis Police Department. Today, it's still run by the state. But St. Louis Mayor Francis Slay says it's time the city runs its own police department. He joked about the old law at his support rally last year.
I will promise the governor that if we get local control back to the people of St. Louis, we will not use our department against the Confederacy. Thank you so much. Thank you for being here. Thank you.
St. Louis spends about $145 million on the police department. That's one-third of the city's operating budget. Brooke Foster with the Safer Missouri Citizens Coalition says residents pay taxes but don't have a say over the police. Her organization is collecting signatures to take the issue to voters in November.
It just makes common sense to give the people of St. Louis control of their own police department, you know, particularly since this is something that is just so outdated. It's been on the books for 150 years.
Efforts to change the law have failed numerous times in the Missouri legislature, but supporters are confident that 2012 is the year St. Louis gets control of its police department. In St. Louis, I'm Julie Bierock for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, clean your room. Clean your room. How much did you hear that when you were growing
up? Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Seems that I only heard that all the while I was growing up. Well, for those of us who never listened to mom's nagging, here's what we might have missed. A teenager in Scotland finally gave in to weeks of badgering from his parents, and as he picked up the mess, he discovered he was sleeping on an old lottery ticket. I mean, sleeping an old lottery ticket. Long story short, he'd been sitting on a winning number for nearly a month.
Whoa.
And the jackpot amounted to roughly $84,000.
Wow.
So dad is now suggesting that maybe his 19-year-old son can finally afford to move out.
Take your money and run.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.